I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Nora Young joins me now. The CBC radio personality has written a new book, The Virtual Self, How Our Digital Lives Are Altering the World Around Us. It's a fascinating book that looks at how we all knowingly and unknowingly generate data about ourselves online. How we feel, what we consume, where we go are all things we keep track of online on one of the many social media sites we maintain. There are good things about it, of course. We can see what we're doing, looking at our habits, improving ourselves thanks to our own data, whether it's a loyalty program, a mood tracker, or a calorie counter. Businesses can use it to track their customers and their habits. And there are bad things. What about where this data resides? What if it's misappropriated by criminals? Say it gets in the hands of the wrong people. Ms. Young, in this book, does a fine job warning us of the pitfalls and arms the reader with ideas on how to be more savvy. It's a great chronicle of how our world has changed for better and for worse. Nora Young is the host and creator of Spark, the weekly program on CBC Radio that looks at technology and culture. She was the founding host of Definitely Not the Opera. Her website is at norayoung.ca, and you can follow her on Twitter. Her handle is Nora3000. The book is published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Nora Young. Ms. Young, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me, Joe.
You're very welcome. Thanks for joining us. So how did you get the idea to look at our technology and our lives in this book the way you have?
Well, you know, I started to observe the extent to which ordinary, regular people, not people who are, you know, particularly obsessive or particularly narcissistic, were starting to keep track of just this sort of everyday things. And you see this a lot with people who, you know, will run and track their runs on their Nike Plus run system and so forth. And I thought, you know, there's something interesting going on here. And as I looked around, I started to see more and more examples of this kind of stuff. And this is, I'm talking about kind of in the fall and winter of 2009, 2010. And since then, it's only really picked up steam. I must say that early on in the process of researching the book, I tried out this little productivity tool called Rescue Time. And what Rescue Time lets you do is basically you install the software on your computer and you list your productive and unproductive activities. And then it essentially tracks you as you use your computer, and it documents, you know, how long you've spent on gossip websites versus how long you've spent on word processing programs and so forth. And then it gives you a weekly productivity guide. And when I saw that, in some ways I knew that I'd sort of seen the future, in the sense that as we use more and more digital tools that, so to say, know how they're being used, the easier it is to capture all these incredible metrics about how we're spending our time, both for good and for ill.
Yeah. So did you, so you thought it when you started the process of thinking about what we're doing, that that this was just the preserve, say, of the neurotic or the self-absorbed even?
You know, I have to admit my initial bias going in was a little bit more around, this is really odd that people are doing this so much, and especially kind of wanting to share all that information with other people and, you know, keep these great graphics of what they're doing and so forth. But as I got more into it, first of all, I started to talk to people who were doing it in a way that I think suggested they had a lot of consciousness around what they were doing. And also, I started to see the ways in which it was beneficial. So I think before I started really researching it, my bias was probably a little bit more on the negative side. But I changed my opinion about some, though not all of it, as I went through the process.
But Ben Franklin, as we learn in the book, did stuff like this, right?
Yeah. He's a he's a really, really, I mean, obviously he's an interesting character for us humans anyway. But what I found so interesting was that he had this period where he tried to do what he called arriving at moral perfection, which is like, I mean, first of all, to try and do that in itself is kind of astonishing as a goal, but he came up with really what was a technology. I mean, it was a book that he designed, but that in itself is a kind of technology where he would track, he had like 13 virtues that he was aiming for, and he would sort of track whenever he did something against one of those virtues when he slipped. And his goal was essentially to produce a perfectly clean book with no moral slips at all. And he would do it for his period of 13 weeks, one virtue per week, and then he would start the whole process again. And when I read about that, I thought, well, his tools are really different. And the kind of things that he's tracking, like this sort of moral dimension, is different. But I think that that impulse towards perfectibility and relying on technologies to kind of meet our goals is something that feels very familiar to us. And to me, it seemed very modern, what he was doing.
So the idea of how we use, say, Facebook, Twitter, sort of the social media sites that we all use, the reasons we use those, they're not the same for every person, are they?
No, I mean, I think they're, you know...
And should they be, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, some people use them simply for sort of staying connected with people or for finding communities of common interest, which is obviously, you know, just a very practical use that we have for these things, and that's a practical use for self-tracking, too, right? Like, if I'm a cyclist, I might want to track the routes that I'm cycling and stay connected to other people who also like to cycle and learn where they like to cycle.
Right.
So there's some very practical reasons for doing that. You know, I think for some of us, there's that sense of social media sites as being things that we do to craft, you know, brand Joe or brand Nora in a way that I personally find a little bit problematic. And I think other people, you know, I met other people in the course of the book, particularly self-trackers, who they're not even necessarily super interested in reaching a goal, like losing weight or whatever. They're really, it's almost an aesthetic pleasure of documenting these things and seeing the pattern that emerges. So I think there are lots of different reasons why people kind of engage in this tracking. And some people try to get really, really complete pictures of their lives and what they're doing. And for other people, it's one particular thing, one particular behavior that they're trying to keep an eye on.
They're either showing off or creating their sort of narrative, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, it's funny. We were talking about this at work around Spark the other day, is the phenomenon that you see now. I see it quite a bit on Twitter, maybe you do too, where people who are somehow automatically pushing out information about their fitness goals to their Twitter feed. So you're getting these little updates from people that are basically saying, you know, I just ran 5 kilometers. Like, good for you, my friend. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. So I definitely think there are cases where this kind of stuff can be sort of narcissistic and can be, you know, your sort of classic example of oversharing. But I think if they're used in a way that's kind of conscious, you can actually use them for personal insight or to connect with people who are like-minded and that type of thing.
Have you found that it's become compulsive for a lot of people?
I haven't met tons of people who are compulsive in the sense of tracking every little aspect of their lives. I think for a lot of us, you know, for instance, if you use Twitter or Facebook, I think a lot of us can relate to that feeling of having to check it all the time.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you see the little, like, light above your at replies on, you know, your Twitter client, and you're, like, compelled to just go and check, sometimes even if there's somebody in the room with you, and it kind of pulls you out of the experience of here and now. So I think it is definitely possible to get compulsive in the use of these types of tools. I also think it's possible to get compulsive about wanting to... I mean, I'm all for self-improvement, but I think in a way you can get kind of driven around that sense of, you know, personal betterment and less around self-acceptance and more around constantly achieving or performing. And that, I think, is a danger for some people, though I think for a lot of people they're able to use it in a way that's a lot more balanced.
Taking a step back and looking at what we've become, have we changed a great deal over the last 5 years because of say, all these things of data collecting, the internet, Twitter, Facebook, social media? Is it too soon to tell?
I think, I mean, I don't know if we've changed at some, like, deep constitutive kind of way. I think it's certainly had a radical impact on the way that we connect socially with other people, in terms of, I mean, I think everybody can relate to that feeling of having what Clive Thompson has called that ambient awareness that we have now, of being just sort of slightly aware of what the people in our lives are doing, passively aware, because we've sort of seen their, you know, their news feed in Facebook, or we've seen what they're up to on Twitter or whatever. And that is really a different, that's really a different thing. You know, we can remember, it's not that long ago, like 5 or 6 years ago, when being with your friends meant this period of doing this quaint thing that we call catching up, right? Where you would actually sit down with somebody and say, so what have you been doing for the last 3 weeks? And, you know, getting a more complete narrative of what people have been doing and what role the events and experiences that they've had have played in their lives. Whereas now, in a way, for lots of us, we don't even need to really catch up with people any longer, because we have this constant sort of passive awareness of what the people in our lives are up to, or even how they're feeling, you know? Like, I've had the experience on Facebook where people that I've been somewhat peripherally connected to have, you know, been going through something particularly intense in their lives, and suddenly you have this window into what they're going through, which is probably a lot more revealing than what they would actually reveal to you face-to-face, yet somehow, you know, this is the nature of privacy settings and the ease of sharing, that it does make for that kind of level of passive sharing that is much greater than what we would have done in a very short period of time, 4, 5, 6 years.
Yeah, and so this goes into another part of the book that I found interesting, and that is, do you find that we're generally responsible online?
I think most people intend to be fairly responsible online. But I do think that this is a question of where the design of technology becomes important. I did come across one study, which is a small study, but it's nonetheless interesting, which was looking at students from, I believe it was Columbia University, who all said that they, and these are people you might imagine, you know, they're young university students, you might imagine them being quite tech savvy, and they all said, no, protecting my privacy is important on social networks, and I actively take steps to protect my privacy. And yet almost all of them, I think, certainly the vast majority, had somehow inadvertently revealed things that they didn't want to reveal. And it does make you think about how much all of us are potentially, because, you know, social media is kind of leaky around the edges of how information gets around. And this is the other feature of digital technology, too, which is that it's very, very good at taking information from one context and putting it into another. And in that way, I think even if we are managing our privacy settings appropriately, sometimes it can come back to bite us. I mean, there was a case of that woman in Quebec who was on disability for depression, and her insurance company looked at her Facebook profile and found pictures of her smiling and on the beach, and used that as grounds to suspect that she, in fact, was not depressed. Now, who knows what the facts of the case were, whether she was, she may, you know, well have been depressed. I have no opinion on that matter. But the interesting thing is that there's certainly nothing wrong or particularly over-disclosing about posting a picture of yourself smiling. It's just that when you take that information from one context and put it into another, it can be used for purposes that you never intended. And this is the nature of the difficulty of, you know, as we like to say, controlling our privacy online, when in fact it's in the character of digital technology to be a bit leaky. And that's why I think it's incumbent on the designers of technology to be as transparent and clear about it as possible.
Have you found that the people that design, say, Facebook, that design these sites, are they hearing the desire of the public to be transparent in that sense, or are they just interested, like, you know, in cashing in that IPO?
Yeah, I mean, there's a tension, right? Because the tension, I think, for any private business is that, it's, I mean, as long as that kind of advertising is the model, there's a business case to be made for people revealing as much about themselves as possible, right? Because it creates a better target market. I think that different social media are better or worse at it. Sometimes I think it's helped just by the design of what the technology is for. I mean, people may overshare on Twitter, but I don't think you could say that Twitter is in any way unclear about it. You know, I mean, it's public by default. You have to choose for things to be private. So there's no lack of clarity in whether people decide to post things that they shouldn't. Well, that's their decision, right? I think that ultimately, you know, and Facebook obviously, partly just because there are so many people using it, has borne the brunt of most of the sort of privacy skirmishes. But ultimately, even there, even some a group as powerful as that, a company as powerful as that, has had to kind of back down when people have really got up on their hind legs. What I would like to encourage people to do is, as this stuff starts to unfold, is that we actually recognize some of our own power in this, and that we seek out media that put more control in our hands, that allow us to own and control our own data, that make it transparently obvious to us how the data is being used and what we're sharing and so forth. And, you know, my hope is that if more services that are really respectful of our data become available, that we'll start to offer those.
Did you read the terms of service agreements that we click yes to?
Do I personally? No.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I do if I have really grave concerns about something,
yeah.
I will. But I have to say I'm pretty much the same as I think the vast majority of other people, which is that my default is just to click
yes.
I agree or to scan it quickly. And but I have to say through the process of thinking a lot about data ownership and data portability of writing this book, that's one thing that I've kind of made as a promise and commitment to myself, is to do better research and to do more due diligence on terms of service agreements. And, you know, part of the issue, too, is that you can read them, but unless you really understand the legalese in which they're written, it might not necessarily be all that helpful to read it. But I have sort of made a personal commitment that I'm going to research those kinds of things more thoroughly.
And that's part of being a data activist, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think we have to remember that we're just at the very early days of this type of technology. I mean, it's hard to believe, really, that it's, you know, we've seen so many changes that have happened and more changes around the corner as we start to use more and more digital devices instead of analog ones. And, I, you know, I'm a journalist. I don't have answers. I have questions. But one of the things that I really feel strongly about is that we have to start talking about this stuff on data. We have to start paying attention to the kinds of things that the Privacy Commissioner is raising red flags about. And we have to make it known that these issues are important to us and that regulation around this is important to us. And I say that partly because we are rushing headlong into contributing this data, but also because I think that there are good and useful things we can do with the data, that there's potentially real benefit from having access to this data at the level of personal insight, but also at the level of kind of what the information in the aggregate can show us about how we are behaving as people. So I think it is important that we think about data activism in the same kind of way that we think about other kinds of activism.
You ask a great question in the book, can data be both useful and anonymous?
Mm-hmm.
Whose responsibility is that? Is that our own responsibility, or is that the companies themselves, the Facebooks, the Twitters?
I think this is still very much an open question. I mean, I think that we have to play a part in it,
mm-hmm.
precisely for those data activism reasons I was referring to.
Yeah.
But I also think that companies need to do a better job on this. They really do need to do a better job on this. And it's interesting, I spoke to this researcher for Spark named Alice Marwick, who was talking about why it's not, was it Alice Marwick? It may not have been Alice Marwick. Anyway, I was talking to a researcher who was talking about why it's not sufficient to say, well, if you don't like Facebook, just get off.
Yeah.
And her analogy was to the fact that, you know, we hold businesses responsible to all kinds of standards in an ethical way. We hold them responsible for environmental standards, for not, you know, just pawning off their negative externalities on the broader community. And there's really no reason that we can't hold them responsible for ethical data practices as well, for being transparent about what's happening with our information and protecting it.
I've listened to Spark on occasion, and I really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
It's been on for what, 5 years now, has it?
Yeah, we're coming to the end of our fifth season.
Yeah. How many people do the show with you?
So there are four of us that work on the team, two of us, myself and Anshuman Idemsetti, don't work full-time on the show. So there are two people who are full-time and two people who are not.
Yeah. What I found when I hear it, and I should do it more often, download it on my iPod, which, mm-hmm. is that the audience is quite engaged. Who are they? Are they the tech savvy, or are they people that are interested in technology and perhaps not that savvy?
Well, it's interesting. We have what we think are, and I have to say that now you're talking about analyzing data, I don't have great data on it, but what we believe to be true is that in a way there are two audiences, right? There's the regular over-the-air radio listeners, mm-hmm. who, people's behavior with radio listening is that they tend to listen to their radio station, right? And so CBC radio listeners tend to be people who listen to CBC radio, so they're listening to Spark, but they're also listening to, the show about spirituality, which comes afterwards, or they're listening to a comedy show that comes before. So they're generally people who are intelligent, engaged, curious people, but they're not necessarily specifically knowledgeable or even specifically interested in technology. And then, the podcast, really, because it's such an opt-in thing, I don't know if your podcasting habits are the same as mine, but I tend to pick things that are related to my specific interests when I look for podcasts. Mm-hmm. And so our sense of it is that the podcasting audience tends to be a little bit more tech-focused and tech-oriented. And so one of the things that we've done is we include a podcast feed called Spark Plus, where you can also get longer form interviews that tend to go a little bit more into depth about technological issues, so that if you're listening to the podcast and you want to get more in depth, then we can really go in the weekly program. You can get those extra bits too. And I mean, this is the great thing about having the digital presence too, is that, online, whether that's on the blog or through our Twitter feed or whatever, we can engage with people who are more tech savvy or who want to contribute to the show or want to talk and wrestle about more in-depth technological issues in a way that is really difficult to do with the broadcast, partly because you have the general audience and partly because, it's finite in terms of the length of time that you can spend doing it. It's just a once-a-week broadcast, whereas digitally it can fold over a much longer period of time.
Well, we've heard of cuts to the CBC, and they doubtless affect the radio division. Mm-hmm. Have they affected your part of the world there at the Mother Corp?
Not as yet. Mm-hmm. The process, the sort of nature of the process now is that the cutbacks have been announced as to where they'll happen, but then there's a little bit of because it's a unionized work structure, there's a little bit of, what they call bumping, which happens mm-hmm. now. So we won't really know exactly how everything shakes out for a little while yet, though I would say that in general what's happened is that certainly I think television felt things a bit more acutely than we did on the radio side.
Nora, I like Spark, and it's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. This is a great book. Congratulations and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure, Joe. Thanks.
You're very welcome. The website for more, norayoung.ca. The book is called The Virtual Self, How Our Digital Lives Are Altering the World Around Us. She's on the line from Toronto. Nora Young, its author. The book is published, by the way, by McClelland & Stewart. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.